All right, good afternoon. Thank you all for being here. I want to thank Tarek and Craig for arranging me to be out here and to all of you for being willing to come listen to a lawyer. As Tarek said, this talk is coming out of the book that Mindy and I have been working on for several years now, that derived from our increasing discomfort with the sustainability goals and stationarity narratives that were coming out of environmental law, which will all make more sense here, I hope, in a second. But I want to take you back to last August when President Obama expanded the boundaries of the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. It had been a very large marine reserve before he expanded the boundaries, but he made it much larger. I've actually had the privilege of going out there to do some research. It's one of the last pristine-ish is the word that they use, coral reefs in the world. It does sit in the middle of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, so it's not pristine, but it's very hard to get to, and fishing has always been fairly difficult. So when it was set up originally, there were basically seven fishers with federal lobster permits. There were only the only fishers left and they were phased out. So it was set up originally, like I said, boundaries expanded, and the immediate reaction was this is damaging marine fisheries. There was an outcry from the Hawaiian longline fishers. The expanded boundaries did get into some of their fishing grounds, and the net result of the news coverage, depending on what newspaper you like to read, is this is really cool. We've done something great for the rest of the world. This is the coral reef ecosystem that is most likely to survive climate change, particularly given what's been going on with the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. The other side of it was more impingement on ocean commercial fishing, and this has got to stop. So it was an interesting moment for me. Mindy is the terrestrial person. I am the water person, the marine person, so you're going to get to hear about marine stuff because that's what I did for the book. But a couple of caveats before we get going. Like I said, the End in Sustainability Project is most directly a response to the fact that U.S. environmental and natural resources law are really based on a vision of ecological systems as relatively stable, relatively stationary, and they continue in that vein despite the fact of climate change and other things we've been doing to change ecological systems. And this is largely historical. Most of the major federal environmental natural resources statutes came into being between 1969 and 1980. So fairly limited decade, and the last major amendment to any of them was in 1990. And they really incorporated that steady state vision of ecological systems that was prevalent at the time, balance of nature approach, and have never really been amended or rethought to incorporate new knowledge from ecology that's not really the way complex ecosystems work. So that was beginning caveat number one. Beginning caveat number two, less necessary, I think, to this audience than many I speak to, but we're not using resilience in a generic sense, but rather focusing on the specific concept of ecological resilience and resilience theory. And then finally, as a result of many presentations that both Mindy and I have given, how you're going to react to some of this is probably going to depend in part on where you think we are in climate change. So we think it's important, we think it's bad, and we think we need to respond to it legally. If you're not there yet, you're going to disagree with a lot of our conclusions. All right. So the basic issue we're confronting is whether sustainability, which gets written into laws by itself, and sustainable development are the correct cultural narratives and legal frameworks for natural resources management in our world of continuous, increasing, unpredictable, unprecedented changes to the resources we're trying to manage. And we suspect that these changes are likely to limit some of our choices in the future. So that's the issue we're taking on. And the example I provide is from fisheries management. So the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act is the federal statute that regulates fisheries in the United States more than 3 miles offshore. States get the first 3 miles for the most part. And the conservation goal is what Congress called optimum yield, which it very consciously based on a term of art it borrowed from fisheries, maximum sustainable yield. So optimum yield is maximum sustainable yield adjusted for economic, social, and possibly environmental. Well, that comes up far less frequently. Factors. And so the goal, after a couple of amendments, was any fishery that's overfished or being overfished should be cut back to the point where you can ensure maximum sustainable yield forever, theoretically.
Dr. Craig?
Yes. The act is 1976. The two major amendments are 1996, and there was another set in 2016, but they didn't change the fundamental structure. There was a more minor amendment in 1978 or 79. Okay. All right. So what does all that mean in the Anthropocene? So two big problems with maximum sustainable yield-based fisheries management, at least as it's been interpreted for the last 40 or so years, is that it assumes, and I can point you to NOAA regulations that actually pretty much say this, that fish that are not needed for reproducing the next generation of fish are surplus. They're not doing anything in the system. And therefore, free for the taking, we can haul them out of the ocean and nothing else will happen. That, of course, ignores the fact that those quote-unquote surplus fish are probably doing something else, like feeding another species or feeding on a species that need to be kept in check or something. But more importantly, if you're looking at this from a climate change perspective, it assumes that the long-term ecological conditions of the oceans are in fact stable, that we can predict how fish will behave next year based on what they've been doing for the last 10 years. And that's just not the case. So if you're looking at impacts on fishing in the ocean, overfishing is itself a big impact. Lots of documentation that commercially fished species around the world have declined, that the large apex predators have been taken out of the system. The World Bank, which is not an ultra-liberal organization, shall we say. The World Bank itself has come out with reports that said, look, fisheries are at the point that they no longer respond to price signals. Commercial marine fisheries no longer respond to price signals. Doesn't matter how much people are willing to pay for the next tuna, it's not there. So for the World Bank to say that is kind of, to me, an important signal that we're sort of at the limit, despite increased catch effort. And that's got some ecosystem effects. I say, apex predators were the main targets originally, but in many, many fisheries around the world, what is considered the fish you're trying to catch has been moving down the food web. Things that were considered trash fish a generation ago are now the target species. A good example of that in the United States is about 20 years ago, dogfish were the bycatch that you threw away on the East Coast, and now they're the target of fisheries on the East Coast. So having some ecological impacts and some pretty good indication that a lot of the commercially fished species are crashing. So what else have we got going on out there? Some habitat destruction. Congress, in the 1996 amendments to the Magnuson-Stevens Act, tried to put some habitat protections in. Some places they've been pretty decent, some places they haven't. But you get destruction from trawling, you get destruction from coastal development, all sorts of important habitats in the ocean being destroyed. Now, you add climate change into the mix, you get increasing ocean temperatures, and a lot of species are temperature sensitive. So there's pretty good documentation that they are moving poleward. They can go deeper to an extent, but pressures are a factor, so they tend to be migrating poleward. If you're thinking in terms of the legal aspects of fisheries management, there are actually three different management councils, zones on the east coast of the United States. Some of these species are migrating from regulatory jurisdiction to regulatory jurisdiction and then heading into Canada. So that's important for legal reasons as well as biological reasons. And the number of species that have been documented as moving and moving fairly far has increased over time. So pretty good evidence that species are migrating. Plus, we got climate change's evil twin. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere gets absorbed by the oceans. It's one of the reasons why climate change hasn't been worse than it is. But that changes the pH of the oceans. And so it basically acidifies the oceans. Oceans are normally about 8.16 pH. Varies from place to place, but the pH is dropping. And that's particularly bad for marine organisms that like to form shells. So this is a pteropod. It's being used or being developed as an indicator species off the coast of Washington, which has particularly bad ocean acidification problems. This is what decreasing the pH does to its shell development. These are actually photos from a lab experiment, but Washington biologists have now found this in the wild off the coast of Washington. So it is having an impact. So, and what that does over time, you increase the temperature, you decrease the pH, and you lose biodiversity, particularly for certain kinds of ecosystems like coral reefs. Coral reefs are sensitive to temperature, they're sensitive to habitat destruction, they're shell-forming organisms, so they're sensitive to ocean acidification. A lot of them are also overfished to begin with, so the projection, well, what's been happening to coral reefs is not great, and the projections are even worse. So that's one of the projections of what they will look like in the future, which, like I said, is pretty important. We protected the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And these are the projected just U.S. losses of corals in different scenarios over time. All right. So what does all that have to do with sustainable development? Well, I focus on coral reefs to start with for a reason, because they're also tremendously socially and economically important to the communities that surround them. They have huge economic value. They provide a lot of jobs. They provide a lot of subsistence fishing. They provide a lot of tourism income. And again, the projections are that there are a lot of communities in the world that depend on their coral reefs who are not going to have the capacity, or currently lack the capacity, I should probably phrase it as, to adapt to the loss of those values in their societies. Now, Australia is obviously going to be fine, but many, many other nations of the world depend on those reefs and don't have quite the adaptive capacity that they will probably need. And that goes along with social and economic vulnerability to the losses of those reefs. As in most graphs, the redder you are, the more worried we are. So again, the social and economic vulnerability up there with lack of adaptive capacity. All right, so what about on the fishery side, moving away from coral reefs and back to fisheries? So this was a projection that came out in Science in 2006. If commercial fishing goes the way it is, things go as they are, Then the projection was that most of the world's fish stocks would be commercially extinct, not actually extinct, but commercially extinct by about 2048 and 2052. So not great on the commercial fishery side. And so the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, in its latest report actually started trying to translate this into risks of food production, risks of food loss for various countries or various parts of the ocean around the world. At least in the short term, some places do get better, but in the long term, pretty much everything turns yellow to black, so fishery production predicted to go down in terms of food supply. All right, and in the social side, there are increasing numbers of documented incidents of slavery or slavery-like arrangements. I'm very careful about using the term actual slavery, but arrangements that are so close to slavery, it's not worth distinguishing the two. Particularly in West Africa, a lot of children have been drafted into fishing fleets, not getting paid, not being well cared for, because it's no longer profitable to pay the crew. It's so hard to find the fish. The boats have to be out for so long that they can't afford to pay the crew. They're not making enough money to pay the crew. And so various immigrants, various, like I said, children in particular, have been drafted, shanghaied, coerced, sold by their parents. There's a variety of ways they end up in these fisheries, but basically are unpaid, not well taken care of, equivalent of slaves. This made headlines in the United States for about a week when it was found that the United States was importing fish caught in these fisheries. Anybody remember that? No. Okay. Yeah, it flashed and then it disappeared. All right. In part because we had a sort of minor election going on about the same time. But, you know, it's the kind of issue that might have stirred up some consumer response, and it did for a couple of days, and then it just faded from the news. But it's still going on, and we still do import a lot of the fish caught this way. So, what does all that have to do with law and narratives? And so, when Mindy and I set off on this project, we were originally just going to talk about law, but then we realized we couldn't really talk about the law without talking about the narratives we tell ourselves about our relationship to the rest of the world. That because our laws are based on an incorrect narrative about how ecosystems work, we really have to get into what stories we tell ourselves. So one of the prominent U.S. narratives is that humans are controlling engineers, that, you know, we can make the environment do whatever we want it to do. This, you can really trace in the literature, started emerging as part of World War II when we ramped up to fight World War II, and then, of course, the detonation of the atomic bomb. And very shortly thereafter, putting a man on the moon, really kind of was a technological high, that we can have the environment we want, environment writ large, through technology. And so that is a narrative that continues to persist and is actually worked into a lot of environmental law. There's a whole lot of environmental standards that are what are called technology-based controls. We set the legal standard on the basis of what technology has accomplished in some statute, is accomplishing in others, can accomplish in others, but still based on technological predictions of what we can do. So wastewater treatment is one example. Wastewater treatment standards are based on what you can accomplish with a cost-benefit analysis thrown in a typical waste treatment plant. And this is an advance on that. So if you've been to Orange County, they have a wonderful water reclamation plant where they actually capture their sewage and treat it back to better than drinking water standards and use it for a variety of things. including recharging their aquifers and future drinking water supplies. So, but again, this is all based on what you can accomplish technologically. There's technological regulation of power plants all over the place. As you all probably know, our clean power plan is in legal disarray at the moment, but we'll see what happens with that. But even before that, power plants, because they take in so much water and because they can emit so many pollutants into the air, have been subject to fairly extensive regulation. The water they take in, the water they put out, the stuff they put in the air, but all of that, again, is based on what can be accomplished technologically. And under the way the acts work, there's EPA can't go beyond what is allowed technologically. So this is just an example of a scrubber system. And the cooling water intake regulations for power plants were, before the Clean Power Plan, the last big fight for power plants. They take in so much water so fast. How do we keep power plants from killing all of the aquatic ecology of the stream? And then, of course, the new fight, one of the fights under the Clean Power Plan, is the dependence on carbon sequestration as a way of dealing with the carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. Is this technologically feasible at scale, et cetera, et cetera? But again, technology is what will guarantee our environmental quality. All right. Taking that narrative and putting it on pause for a second, we'll come back to it. That gets wrapped into a whole bunch of sustainable development narratives in the United States, and I will say there are a lot of different definitions of sustainable development out there, but these are the ones that crop up in the United States. So basic idea that you should be thinking about social, environmental, and economic impacts all at the same time, that we want to have development that achieves social equity, preserves environmental amenities, but allows for economic development at the same time. And so how do you portray that? Well, if you Google sustainable development in the United States, this is a picture that's likely to pop up first. It's called the Three Pillars Model of Sustainable Development. And what's interesting about it is it's always pictured with the environment in the middle, which means you could actually just kind of flick that middle out and still have sustainable development. And believe it or not, this is not something I made up. The people who do kind of advertising literature, believe it or not, what messages are conveyed with advertising. So that's one of the things this picture conveys, is that middle pillar isn't all that important. If you don't get that model, you'll get this model, the overlapping circles model of sustainable development. Sustainable development nested in there is the bullseye. That's what you're aiming for. But if you're going to do a counter narrative read, there's no bad place to be on this diagram. Okay? There's just no bad place to be. There are better places, but there's no bad place. And so it again conveys that there's a whole range of choices that society can make without bringing ecological dependence into the mix. That's one value you can trade off against the other two, if you so desire. So, and then on top of that, so we got a technological narrative that's a little overwhelming. We got some sustainable development narratives that aren't working so well. And then we've got climate change narratives that in the United States, and again, this is very specific to the United States, that aren't helping either. So, you know, the one America is famous for, climate change isn't happening. It's a socialist scam. I like the Newsweek cover, although the asterisk is important because it wasn't actually proclaiming that global warming is a hoax. And, you know, the dinosaurs claiming climate change is a hoax. So, like I said, this is the narrative we're known for. We still have relatively high percentages of people who will deny that climate change is happening compared to the rest of the world. And, of course, we have our current president, which I won't comment on. So, the second narrative we have about climate change in the United States is it isn't us. And so these surveys are a little old at this point, but it hasn't changed a whole lot. So even if it's happening, it's not human responsibility. Therefore, we don't have to take any responsibility for it. Those are two very disempowering narratives if you're trying to reform the law. If it's not happening, there's no reason to change the law. If it's not us, not a whole lot that changing the law will help with. The third narrative is the recurrence of that technology theme. Technology will save us. And so the biggest place this comes out is in the geoengineering camps, that we will do something, mirrors in the atmosphere or putting gases into the atmosphere, cloud seeding. Maybe we'll put some iron in the oceans, which we've had some rogue experiments on. And, you know, but whatever. We'll figure out the technology, and technology will save us. I find these disturbing on a number of levels, some legal, some just scary. But the one thing I will point out is if you're an oceans person, the one thing none of them take care of is ocean acidification. So that's my last comment to anyone who's in geoengineering. When you come up with something to take care of ocean acidification, we'll talk. But so far, you haven't. And then, you know, this was one of New York's responses after Hurricane Sandy, is we'll just put this big barrier in to keep the high waters out. Any place that has experienced flooding on a regular basis will tell you that doesn't tend to work. They didn't actually do it, but that was one of the initial responses. Again, will technology our way out of it? All right, the third narrative, also quintessentially American. It's the end of the world as we know it. I got kind of on a pop song theme here for a while, but it's the end of the world as we know it. And this is important to Americans because Americans, more than any other culture in the world, have a very strong cultural apocalyptic narrative. Part of it is religious, part of it is secular, but it is ingrained into the fabric of American culture. And, you know, the day after tomorrow, whatever you think of its science, it was definitely an apocalyptic movie about climate change. So very, very easy for Americans in particular to fit climate change into an apocalyptic narrative. So we've got, well, and it's got a couple of variations. This is a really good book if any of you are interested in it, but the our myth of the apocalypse is woven very deeply into our culture. And so there's a couple variations on that, not helpful either. One I call the Carpe Diem or Party Like It's 1999. The best example of that, basically the theme of this is if it's all going to go away, we might as well just use it all up while we've got the chance. Best example of that is when NASA announced that the melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet or collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet was inevitable. Forbes immediately came back with this headline, if it's past the point of no return, we should do less about climate change, not more. Completely ignoring many, many things, like there's a whole rest of the world to worry about, but that's a good example of the Carpe Diem narrative. So we've got four narratives about climate change in the U.S., three of which are pretty disempowering. It's not us, it's not happening, and it's the apocalypse, all pretty disempowering. Technology will save us, a little bit of hubris, shall we say, in that one. Not particularly helpful. So what do we recommend instead? Well, we like the trickster. American culture, anthropologists will also tell you, European-derived American culture, I should be careful about that one, is also one of the few cultures in the world that does not have a trickster figure. Murphy of Murphy's Law is about as close as we get. You know, if anything will go wrong, it will. But in other cultures, what the trickster stories tell you is there are forces out there that are going to surprise you. They're going to change things up. They can be a little scary sometimes. If you're into Norse mythology, Loki is one of the scarier tricksters out there. But humans can still cope. And that surprises, that changes, that alterations are actually kind of big, like getting the sun, getting seasons, or, you know, they're pretty big, but humans cope. And it's a nice middle narrative, unlike the ones we've been discussing, where humans are still empowered. There's still things we can do, but we can't control everything. And so culturally, this is the narrative we think is missing. And so if you think about climate change as a trickster, we know that we've had the 10 hottest years in 2016. I think we'll be on here as well. But that's experienced differently in different parts of the world. The fact that it's a hot year doesn't mean everybody in the world is having the same kind of things happen to them. And so, again, you got that unpredictability. Things don't happen as you expect. And even in the United States, in 2015, that hottest year on record, it didn't mean the same thing for even different parts of the United States. Some places were having record cold in the hottest year on record. So, again, it's a surprise. And that's what we need to learn to deal with. Now, some other things that are out there we think are helpful. The global footprint concept, you know, how many resources, if you're thinking about natural resources management, how many resources are we consuming each year? More than we should be is the point of most of these studies. And this is Earth Overshoot Day, the day in which we have used all the resources that could be replaced that year. And it's been getting earlier and earlier and earlier in the year, I guess is the point of this graph. But if we stay on business as usual, we'll be at needing two Earth's worth of resources every year, which we don't have. But again, you could change that trajectory. All right, so like I said, it's been getting earlier and earlier in the year. Then the third set of narratives, third set of way of looking at things is the planetary boundary studies. 2009, a group of researchers out of the Stockholm Resilience Center came up with 9 key boundaries for the planet and how close we were to overshooting them. Some of them were in serious trouble of overshooting. This was the refinement in 2015. But again, a different way of thinking about how much space, how many resources can we consume. There's space to operate, but there's also ways we can get ourselves in trouble. So, and then this is where resilience theory comes in, because on the science side, has the description of complex ecosystems as always in changing, always in flux, going through different phases of an adaptive cycle, sometimes growing rapidly, sometimes relatively stable, sometimes releasing into kind of reorganization phase, and that these systems are operating at different scales, different temporal scales, different spatial scales, in ways that interact and aren't always predictable. So among other things, if you're translating this into law, you can't always be sure that the same management action you did last year will produce the same result next year. It kind of depends on what else is going on in these linked systems. So again, a little bit of surprise, a little bit of you have some control, but not in complete control. All right. And again, you get the different outcomes. If you get a shock or a stress and it hits at one phase of that adaptive cycle, the system might respond one way. If it hits at a different phase, say at a release phase, it might respond in a very, very different way. Plus the whole idea that ecological systems can exist in different states. So there's not this balance of nature. The system's always trying to get back to where it started. It's quite happy sometimes to flip into a different state of being. And we might not like that different state of being as well as we like the previous one. Or we might like it better. It could go either way. But we need to be aware that, again, nature's not trying to help us out. It's not trying to get back to where we started necessarily. All right, so why we think this is an improvement. Resilience thinking theory acknowledges that sudden and unpredictable change is a reality of life, which our current laws do not. Unlike sustainability and sustainable development, resilience thinking provides a system that acknowledges that what humans can achieve can change over time. And it's also important, though, that resilience itself is a property of these systems, not a goal. So we still need law and policy. We need the politics to figure out where we're taking this understanding. And we need to be rethinking those goals, given that we are in a changing world. So the first normative question for resilience thinking in fisheries law is the resilience of what, to what, and for whom. So if you're thinking fisheries management, if you're managing for the fishing communities, for the economic stability of the fishing communities, you might come up with different answers than if you're managing for the continued existence of the fish themselves. Those don't necessarily lead you to the same regulatory and management regime. And that's where law has to step up to the plate, that we can't default on making those hard choices, and some of them are, in fact, very hard choices, or are about to be very hard choices. And so what we suggest in our chapter on marine systems is that the law should be promoting the resilience of changing marine ecosystems to climate change and ocean acidification for the benefit of future generations, very consciously being willing to say the fishing communities, commercial communities that depend on commercial marine fishing, are not necessarily our priority. Now, we don't want to ignore them. There's other things we can do to help them out. But if you think about it in the reverse, if we allow all those fisheries to collapse, they're not going to be in very good shape either. So it, we think of it as a hard choice, but that's the choice we suggest we should be making about. But we acknowledge this is a political choice, political legal choice, and we could well see it going a different direction. So more specifically, the concept of panarchy, those nested adaptive cycles, counsel that some of the anthropogenic impacts on fish and marine ecosystems are operating at scales beyond effective immediate human intervention. So climate change is on a century scale. If we stopped all carbon dioxide emissions tomorrow, greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, we'd still have climate change for at least a couple of centuries. Ocean acidification operates on a millennial scale, which is a little disturbing. But that means, you know, we can't turn that off tomorrow. That's not going to be the most effective legal intervention. It's definitely something to deal with, but if we're looking for the most effective interventions, we need to be looking a little closer to home for the first steps. Like some of these pollution problems, ocean plastic pollution, also kind of tough to deal with, but a little easier, or a little faster, I should say, not easier, than climate change, getting rid of climate change impacts. Like, so we got a couple centuries of that regardless. We got legacy toxic pollution out in the ocean. We should probably be thinking about what to do. Existing coastal development is probably not moving, but it's going to have some severe complications we should be thinking about. But short term, the two things we could really intervene on right now, tomorrow if we wanted to, land-based pollution, about 80% of the pollution that reaches the ocean comes from the land. We know that. We know what it is. We actually know how to stop a lot of it. Political will to do it is not there, but that actually is an intervention that can happen short term. And fisheries, again, you can stop a fishery tomorrow if you've got good enough reason to do it. So these are the two we focus on, but particularly fisheries, because they are where law can make the most difference the fastest. Not that we should be ignoring the rest of them, but we're stuck with those other legacies for a bit, regardless of what we do legally. All right, so along those same lines, we can protect the last best places, which is why I'm thrilled that President Obama did extend the protections for the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. It is one of, like I said, it's likely to be the coral reef that survives. And more generally, I said rising temperatures drive species toward the poles. Ocean acidification is worst in coldest waters. So somewhere in the middle are sweet spots, you know, the Goldilocks. The ocean acidification isn't too bad. The temperature change isn't too bad. We should be finding those spots and protecting them. And we should seriously consider phasing out industrial marine fisheries. I'm gonna be clear here. I'm not going after artisanal. I'm not going after subsistence, but the industrial marine fisheries can be phased out. The choice is often framed as fisheries versus ecosystem, but a resilience view of our trickster Anthropocene says, you know, we may be losing fisheries regardless, so maybe we should be intervening to keep what we can keep for the future. And we can give ourselves that power to give changing marine ecosystems their best chance for a future. So the implications for sustainable development is that the sustainable development narrative also has to come to grips with the changing planet and ecological limits. And this is the original model of sustainable development. And you notice environment's the outer loop. Environment's the limit of what you can do socially and ecologically. And our point is you start shrinking that environmental loop, you start shrinking everything else as well. So this is a different way of thinking about sustainable development that we think could be much more helpful, both culturally and legally. All right, so we do see this as empowerment, even though we titled our book The End of Sustainability. So, you know, we need to be warned that these changes are possible, maybe inevitable in some cases, but we can intervene. We do still have that power to intervene and avoid the worst of the worst. And we can guide the transformations that are inevitable in more productive directions than they might go on their own. So we can, in fact, cope with that trickster. But we're also counseled that if we don't get climate change under control and take mitigation seriously, that trickster is going to get uglier and uglier and bigger and more Loki-like the longer we go on. So thank you. And that's the book, November. And I actually stayed to 45 minutes like I was supposed to, so we have time for questions. And I've stunned you all into silence. All right. That is a wonderful legal question that many people are debating. It can always be changed by Congress. So Congress has complete authority over lands under federal protection. So if Congress wants to get rid of it, no question, Congress can do it. I really don't think it's that high of a priority in Congress. The big issue is whether the president, having done it, can undo it with a stroke of a pen. It was created under a statute called the Antiquities Act, which allows the president on his or her own to create national monuments. So all the terrestrial national monuments were done the same way. But it does not empower the president to undo them. So the best legal reasoning and the consensus of the people who do this kind of law is that no, the president cannot unilaterally undo it. Which raises more objections. All right.
Yeah, I can ask internationally, mm-hmm. what's your forecast? So you talked about our president and what we can do. How about other nations?
How about other nations? Well, Most other nations have signed on to a couple of conventions that we have not, treaties that we have not. The Biodiversity Treaty being a big one. We're one of three nations that has not ratified that convention. The other two are Andorra and the Vatican, if you're curious. So we're in good, you know, big player company. And the other one is the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. Even though we drafted it, we at the last minute decided not to sign on to it. Both of those have some pretty strong international law biodiversity protections, and the Biodiversity Convention has a marine protocol to it that combined the goals are to protect at least 20% of the world's ocean from any extractive use whatsoever. And then to manage fisheries responsibly. There are some enforcement problems with the managing fisheries. Until there's a global GPS requirement, for example, vessels engaged in illegal fishing can just disappear. And some have been documented to have reworked themselves on the high seas and come back as a different vessel. So that's one area where technology actually could help a little bit on the enforcement side. But there are some wonderful things going on. There's a great app, if any of you are interested, called Global Fishing Watch, which is a partner between Google and I'm going to forget the other two people. But you can actually track fishing vessels all over the world and see where they go. And that's been used a couple times to catch already. It's only been up for about 6 months. To catch people that are illegally fishing in marine protected areas. So you can just, I mean, they light up and it's like, you're not supposed to be there. So that's been helping. But there are also some really good agreements on the species that people really care about. So like tuna, every species of tuna has a regional agreement about it. And Australia is to the point where they can real-time track individual bluefin tuna cruising through Australian waters. And they just transmit that to fishermen. It's like, don't even be near this area because that's where the bluefin are. So it's improving. But like I said, international marine protections are, I would say, about five steps ahead of the United States at the moment. You had a question.
When we throw in population growth,
yes,
and the increase in economic well-being of a couple of countries that have, you know, China and India, where certainly consumerism is increasing rapidly because of an increasing economy and so forth. And you see the 10 billion people that are to be predicted for 2050 or so. And all the things that I'm sure your partner deals with, you know, everything from disappearance of arable land, forests, all the stuff that's terrestrial. How can you not believe in the end of sustainability?
Well, that was kind of our question. Because if you throw on top of that the basis of feeding and housing and providing water to those people are also changing at the same time, you know, that's actually how we came together originally, about 7 years ago now, was... It's like, what the heck does sustainable mean under these conditions? What are you trying to sustain? Because if what you're trying to sustain is growth, which, if you read carefully, is usually what people are trying to sustain. I mean, it is sustainable development. That it's development that's trying to be sustained. You're going to run into limits, and they're not hard limits because you can also become more efficient along the way. So a great example of that in the United States is even though our population has been increasing, the total amount of water being used has remained the same or even dropped in some locations. And so, if you become more efficient in how you use the resources, that's one way around it. A big part of the population increase is what to do about food. Well, everyone knows that getting away from a beef diet, which I know is a really bad thing to say in Nebraska, okay, I realize that. But getting away from a beef diet would help in innumerable ways. But that's the question, and then consumerism is a whole third rail in the United States, but if you've designed your economic culture so that you're supposed to throw away your iPhone every 2 years and get the newest model, you have built however green Apple wants to be, and I'm an Apple fan, don't get me wrong, but you've built an unsustainable expectation that can go on forever. And that's why we finally convinced ourselves that you have to get at the cultural narratives as well, that the law alone can't go after that. Now, all of that, if you're a lawyer, makes you very nervous because it starts running you into individual rights. And a large part of the end of our book takes on the question of, have we gone too far in terms of thinking in terms of individual rights versus community rights? And at various times in the United States' history, the founding of the nation being one, World War II being probably the most recent example, the legal pendulum as well as the cultural pendulum has swung toward community first values. Now we swung way the other way, both legally and culturally. And that's the argument we make is really the only end run out of that consumer population resource dilemma is to be able to think in terms of a larger community. And like I said, American culture has been capable of doing that. It's not like we're asking for something that's never happened before. But it's time to swing that pendulum back, because if you go after any of those problems individually, you're going to run it smack into cultural and legal resistance both.
Can those changes happen without a crisis first?
That is the big issue. And I will tell you, I'm the pessimistic side of the team, and she's the optimistic side of the team. So Mindy will tell you yes, and I will tell you no. I would really like to believe that we could do it without a crisis. I actually think we've blown a couple of really good crises in this country that could have been used to take things far back, Katrina being probably the biggest. Yeah. So I'm not even sure a crisis will do it, I guess is the end result of that. But you need something that will capture popular and political attention sufficiently. And maybe it doesn't have to be a crisis, but you need something to spark the change. And then the problem with this level of change is it also has to be maintained for a long time, and Americans haven't proven themselves really good at that either. But when I'm looking at fisheries and I'm contemplating the possibility, how many of you are aware of how much seafood fraud goes on in the United States? A couple of you. Yeah, it's pretty extensive. You're not necessarily eating what you think you're eating. Because what you want to eat can't be caught. We're not in enough numbers to get it to you. So, if people start connecting the dots, that's Mindy's argument, is if people start connecting the dots and seeing that the fact that we have a maximum sustainable yield, and that's the international standard as well, by the way, for fisheries management as well as the United States, we end up with children enslaved. That might be enough. So I'm hoping she's right.
Have you given any thought to how you would change things like NEPA or ESA to account for the trickster?
Okay, well, NEPA is just a planning law as written. So NEPA actually already has some pretty good climate change regulations to it. The newest versions require that if you've got a project that is either federal or needs federal approval or funding, you have to think about what contribution to climate change the project itself is going to make, but you also have to think about how climate change will affect the project over the projected life of the project. So, for example, they're trying to put a new nuclear reactor in Florida's coast. Okay, nuclear reactors on the coast, to me, just bad idea in the first place. But nevertheless, if you're doing the NEPA analysis for that, you have to be thinking in terms of, okay, what does it do in terms of climate change mitigation? Probably net help. But what's going to be happening on that part of Florida's coast 50, 60 years from now, maybe this isn't the best place to put it. So that's already written into NEPA. And courts have been pretty good about enforcing those requirements. The Endangered Species Act could use several amendments to put some flexibility into it. This is not the Congress I want to open the ESA up to. But yeah, it is very much based, despite what several of my friends will say, it is very much grounded in this balance of nature, stationarity model. If you're trying to recover a species, you can only put it in its historic range, even if it can no longer survive in its historic range. So those need some tweaking. But like I said, that's not a statute I really want to invite Congress right now to reinvestigate.
I guess what I was wondering is, you know, what you said about the crisis. I mean, when those crises happen, right, that's when the policy window opens,
yeah.
And you want to have the things ready to throw through it.
Right, so. Right. And that's another problem with the ESA is coming up with the right crises that would induce people to amend the ESA the helpful direction, because you usually, when people want to amend the ESA, it's because the ESA is itself the crisis for the stability of whatever economic social system and economic system we're in. So that one's a little trickier, but yeah, it has needed some fixes for a long time, but it hasn't been substantially amended since 1978. Okay.
What is the liability of a consumption tax
politically or?
Politically,
probably not, but it would be a much better approach to things, in my opinion. I think a carbon tax would be a good way to go as well. So, consumption tax instead of an income tax would, I think, more. With the usual provisos of you gotta let people live. But I think it would be a more straightforward way of getting at that issue than some of the more convoluted ways people have tried.
So I think it's a different twist on things. You called for an end of commercial fishing.
Yes, industrial commercial fishing.
Right. What do you see for an exit strategy? Quick, it's got to be done gradual, or
yeah, I would do a phase out, and that's why I called it a phase out with investment. And this is where Craig is going to start yelling at me, but investment in the more environmentally benign forms of marine aquaculture that are emerging, including on land marine aquaculture, which does not include shrimp or salmon. Okay, before he starts yelling. There's some great... China's the leader in marine aquaculture. China's actually supplying an increasing percentage every year of its seafood consumption by aquaculture.
Right, but all that goes back to wild-caught food to feed the aquaculture.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You gotta promote the right kind, so you don't promote species that need to eat other fish, other marine fish. You promote...
So tilapia.
Tilapia is one. There's a great company in Hawaii called Blue Ocean that's doing a lower trophic level fish that's native to Hawaii, and they grow them in the deeper ocean in these big buckyball things. And they don't feed them. They can feed well enough off the plankton that flows through, and they don't inoculate them with antibiotics, and they've got a business selling it to the local Hawaiian seafood chains, but it's also a native fish, so if it happens to escape, it's supposed to be there anyway. So that's another form that's good. Shellfish aquaculture is actually beneficial to a lot of marine systems. Seaweed aquaculture is taking off in various parts of the world, and again, that's got some benefits of taking up the carbon dioxide, doesn't consume fish, obviously. So there are good forms, there are horrible forms, but there are good forms. So yeah, no shrimp, no salmon, but there are, last time Noah did a count, there are about, I want to say, like 260 species, marine species, that have been aquacultured. So we're, you know, the fact that everybody jumps immediately to salmon and shrimp distorts the actual state of aquaculture science. Not aquaculture economics, but aquaculture science. So.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Craig?
All right, well, thank you for being here. I appreciate it, and have a good evening.